Hi there, welcome to the 6th Annual Transforming Toddlerhood Conference. I'm so happy you're here. I'm your host, Devin Kunzman, toddler expert and the founder of Transforming Toddlerhood. I'm on a mission to dispel the myth that toddlerhood is terrible and empower parents and caregivers to overcome the challenges of toddlerhood, nurture their child's development, and create confidence in their parenting skills. And that's exactly what we're here to do today. And I am thrilled to be here with Alyssa Campbell, founder of Seed and Sow. Welcome, Alyssa.
Hey, thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. And before we dive into all the wonderful things we're going to chat about today, there might be some people watching that aren't familiar with you and your work. So could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. My master's is in early childhood education and child development, and I co-created the Collaborative Emotion Processing Method. It's a guide for building emotional intelligence in kids. And we researched it across the US. We have a book coming out with HarperCollins in October on it, and really helping parents, teachers, and caregivers dive into what this work looks like for ourselves. How do we change the way that we experience children's emotions so that we can respond with intention? And then ultimately, how do we respond with intention? What does that look like?
That's awesome and so needed, especially in the early childhood space, as we know that, you know, this is a really big time for child development, for brain development, social, emotional, cognitive, all the different areas of development. And that's also part of the toddler years and what can make toddlerhood such a challenging time period. And so I wanted to ask you, what do you feel makes toddlerhood a challenging and sometimes misunderstood developmental period?
Totally. Well, I think it's really tough for a few reasons. One, a lot of our like patterns and habits from our childhood are going to come up in this time. And a lot of us didn't grow up in emotionally supportive environments, right? We're like, we were allowed to have big feelings and someone could hold space for those big feelings. And so now when a kid is navigating that and they're two and they're having a big meltdown, we don't have it stored in our body somewhere for like, how do I respond with intention? Like that just doesn't live in our bodies for most of us. I don't know about you, but for me, it was like, sure, you can have that, but like in your room, or it was dismissed. Like, oh my gosh, it's not a big deal, right? Like you got an orange cup instead of a blue cup. And I think for us as adults, it can be really hard to understand what a child's experiencing when it doesn't feel like a big deal to us. We have felt disappointments that feel so much bigger and so much more important than the disappointment of what color your cup is at lunchtime. And so I think one of the biggest barriers is understanding what's happening for a child so that we can start to develop some empathy. And ultimately, we know that empathy and compassion breed that connection, which tend to breed collaboration, which is a real win for all parties involved. But it starts with us really understanding what's happening for them. And it's hard. It's hard to do in the moment.
It really is. It's super challenging. And I think another thing that makes it so challenging is not only do we not necessarily have that muscle memory for how to respond because we didn't have that type of response to ourselves as when we were children, but at the same time, I find that, you know, our brains are fully mature at this point where, you know, as an adult. And so we often, I feel, look at toddlers' behavior from this logical place, right? We're looking at it from our fully mature, logical adult brains. And so we're like, what's the big deal? What's the, you know, because it's hard to really put ourselves into someone else's shoes, especially that person who has little life experience, doesn't have a lot of brain maturation, and isn't really great at regulating their feelings and emotions. And so I think that that's just another barrier to like really fully understanding and putting ourselves into a young child's shoes when the upset is present.
Totally. And I think that you touched on something there that I think is really important of the regulation component. And what happens is when a child is having a hard time, when their nervous system is dysregulated, our nervous system responds to that. You know, when your little guy has like delicious giggles or just like so smiley, and it makes you smile and it makes you laugh. It's contagious. Those feelings are contagious. You feel it in your body. It's the best. When your child's melting down on aisle four, that's also contagious. Your insides are going to react to that. It's called mirror neurons, where our neurological system starts to fire that adrenaline and cortisol. And now we're stuck in this loop with this child. And so we're also at that moment, often not in our logical thinking brain. We're in our reactive brain. And we have to practice self-regulation in order to teach a child how to practice that. We learn self-regulation through co-regulation, and it's not a child's job to get calm for us. It's our job to get calm for them. And if we find ourselves feeling so overwhelmed that we can't get calm, if you just think about that for a second, like, oh my gosh, I'm so overwhelmed, I can't calm my body down. We can't be asking a two-year-old or three-year-old to do this for us, to be like, I need you to be calm so that I can feel better in my body. They're saying the same thing to us. I need you to be calm so that I can feel better in my body. And as we start to build our toolbox for self-regulation, we get to model that and build some tools alongside our children.
Yeah. And it's a challenge, and it's a practice. And just mm-hmm. because it's challenging doesn't mean it's not possible. It just means that, yeah, it's a practice and something that we can, keep working through. And so as we start to think about a toddler's emotions and our emotions and how they all work together, what would you say is at the root of toddler upset? How can we better understand, young children and their upset?
Yeah. So dysregulation is what we're going to focus on first and foremost. We look at, I have what I call the triangle of growth, and we work from the base and we go our way up. And the base of it is the sensory systems. So that is your whole nervous system. And, you know, as adults, like I have felt so many times as a parent, like I want to lay in a dark room where nobody's talking to me. Nobody's asking me for anything. Nobody's on my body. I'm not going through my to-do list in my head. Like just the dream of like, I am going to have a sensory break, really, where my whole body can calm and recover. And from the minute we wake up in the morning, we think of it like a battery, where if you had your phone plugged in overnight, you unplug it, it immediately starts to drain. Whether you're using any apps on it, whether you're texting it, it just immediately starts to drain the battery. The more you use it and the more you use certain apps over others, the faster it drains. And the same thing happens with us. From the minute we wake up in the morning, our body's job is to keep us safe. And so it's looking all around. It's saying, how do these clothes feel on my body? Are there certain lights around me, sounds, all that jazz? And it's processing it to say, am I safe? If a car drives by right now, my brain's going to say, you're safe. You don't have to pay attention to it. You can stay here. If my fire alarm goes off, my brain's going to say, you're not safe. Pay attention to that. And in order to do this work in the background, it's draining that battery all day, which then can leave us in a state of dysregulation. We need to recharge that battery throughout the day proactively so that we're not getting to a place of depletion where it's like the red light battery blinking on your phone. And then we're trying to recharge and then it takes longer to recharge versus, what if we plugged in throughout the day? What if we had little recharges? And that's what we look at for kids too, that everything is harder. Just like we have the word hangry, where when you're hungry, you might feel angry and everything feels harder. And there was a meme I saw the other day. It was like, sorry, I snapped at you. My shirt was uncomfortable and I was a little hungry. And I was like, yeah, like that makes sense to me. And these are kids all the time, right? Like our kids are like, I'm a little hungry, or I'm getting tired, or my socks are really tight, or my sibling's been crying all morning, or there's people moving around, or we're going through all these transitions. I have to put my shoes on and get out the door, and all these steps that are required of me. And it pulls from their battery. And so when we're looking at toddler big emotions, our book's called Tiny Humans, Big Emotions, we focus first on that nervous system of how are we recharging that battery throughout the day proactively. And this is where we're building regulation tools. We can't expect a child or an adult to tap into a regulation tool that they don't have yet in their toolbox. And we practice these all throughout the day in calmer moments, proactively, so that then reactively in the moment, we can say, okay, I know that when my kid does 10 big jumps or spins in an office chair or dips upside down throughout the day, that recharges them. Great. That's a tool I can pull from in the moment. I know that when my kid's melting, before we can talk about the problem, before we can troubleshoot, we have to calm that nervous system first. Here are some activities that we've practiced throughout the day that we can tap into now.
That's so helpful. And when we think about practice, one thing that I'm hearing that I want to reiterate is that we have to practice in the calm moments, in the moments of regulation, in the moments where emotions and behavior are regulated. So that's when children can learn. We can learn when we're not under like stress and duress. And then once we're able to practice those in the calm moments, that's when we'll start seeing some forward motion, I feel, in the challenging moments. But just starting to like introduce concepts, tools, and practices just in the challenging moments, it's going to be a lot harder.
Yeah, exactly. And it's muscle memory. It's neural pathways, is really, if you want to get nerdy, that like when we practice it's like going to the gym, where like you go, if you just went once, like your muscles aren't just going to like magically be stronger the next day in an exponential way. We go over and over and over and over. And as you work them out, they get stronger. And neural pathways happen the same way, where like if every single time my child drops his fork on the ground, this is a very real scenario in my house right now, I say, all right, here you go. Here, it's back. You can try again. Now it's this game. He drops it on the ground. He gets it back. He thinks it's funny. He drops it on the ground. And then I hit a breaking point where I'm like, stop dropping your fork. But I've reinforced this over and over and over in his brain. This is how this works. I drop my fork on the ground. Mom hands it back to me. I think it's funny. I drop my fork on the ground. Mom hands it back to me. I think it's funny. I'm connecting with mom. We're playing a game. And I inside, I'm like, this is not a fun game for me. I don't feel connected. I have to break some part of this habit and pattern to create something new. And the same thing with these coping strategies or regulating tools, that as we start to move through the day in these calmer moments and we're like, oh, I am playing with this puzzle and I can't get this piece in. I'm not like totally dysregulated. I'm not melting down. It's an opportunity for me to show like, oh, I can't get this piece in. I'm too frustrated. Oh, and I'm going to like get into it. And I'm going to go, I need to take a break for a minute. And I put my hand on my chest and I put my hand on my belly and I say, I'm going to take 10 deep breaths. And I will take 10 deep breaths and say each number out loud afterward. And then I come back and I'm like, okay, I feel calmer. I'm ready to practice again. And I'm doing this all in the goal of modeling for him, like in these small moments when I'm working on a puzzle and I feel frustrated, I do this activity to help my body feel calm. And then when it is a little more heightened and maybe we're adding, I'm a little hungry or we've had other transitions and that battery's a little more drained and now there's frustration, now there's something to pull from.
And one thing that I always tell parents and caregivers about this is that you might feel in the moment, you know, you're in your stress response, you're getting frustrated and you're like, there's no time to practice now. I can't, that, you know, because we have this sense of urgency of like, this has to be taken care of right now because we're perceiving a threat. We're in a heightened state. We're in our stress response. And so we oftentimes, I don't know, I notice there's like this sense of urgency. And so the one thing I want to say and reiterate that I always tell my clients that I work with is that as long as your child is safe, you can take the time to get grounded, to practice, because there is not an emergency as long as your child is safe. And so if they're physically safe, then we can take the time to create the emotional safety by calming ourselves, practicing, because, but it's challenging though to fight against that really deep urge, that sense of urgency that seems so real in that moment.
Totally. Well, I think we don't practice with ourselves, right? So if we don't practice with ourselves, we aren't going to be able to practice with a child. So when we start to feel ourselves getting overwhelmed and feeling frustrated, this happened just the other day, we're coming in from a like story hour, like play group. And I have a 20-month-old, and it was just like, we were pushing up against nap time here, and we hadn't had lunch yet. And I was like, cool. I'm like feeling this urgency of like, we have to get inside, and we have groceries in the car. We'd just done pickup. And so I'm trying to get him in. I'm trying to get the groceries in. I need to get lunch. And then I need to get him down. Right. It felt like all of these steps had to happen immediately or else he's going to melt down. And I was starting to get overwhelmed. And then when he is like very slowly walking to the door, I'm like, come on, buddy, come on. We got to get inside. It's time for lunch. Come on, buddy. And I'm like carrying the groceries and I have all these things in my hands and I'm trying to like speed him up. And then he just sat down, just sat. And inside I start to boil. I'm like, we need to move. Like, we haven't had lunch yet. We're running late. Like, he's going to melt down. I start to spiral ahead when I was feeling an overwhelm. And this is the opportunity for us as adults to practice. Like, okay, I'm feeling overwhelmed. It's okay for me to be in that. I'm going to pop these groceries inside. I'm going to come back to my toddler. I sat down on the ground next to him and was like, hey, wow, I was really rushing you. I was nervous that you were going to really have a hard time at lunch and going down for a nap if you were really tired and we got home later than usual. I'm so sorry for rushing you. He didn't understand all of those words. A lot of them were for me, but he knew from my body language and my tone that I'm here to connect and repair. And I was like, do you want to do 10 big frog jumps up to the door with me? And he was like, mm-hmm. And so now we're doing a regulating activity. We're moving our body together as a part of this transition to move through. But it took me recognizing my own dysregulation to slow myself down so that then I could be present to him. And I think so often we don't practice this with ourselves. And so then when a kid is having a hard time, it's hard for us to slow down and practice it with them.
Yeah. And it's amazing. This example that you just gave us is so awesome because it also shows the power of connection and how we don't necessarily need discipline or discipline tools in moments where we think like, we need a consequence or we need something, you know, where actually connection is what saved the day in this scenario. And by creating connection and the type of connection that I heard you use an example of was playfulness, that really supported moving forward, and not to mention the validation and everything. And one thing I want to point out for people who are listening, they might be thinking, because I get this question all the time. Okay, but my little one is, you know, as you said, like 20 months or 18 months or 15 months, and they don't understand what I'm saying. So I feel like this is too advanced for my child. The one thing I always say is yes, and kids understand. They understand the receptive language before expressive language. So they're going to understand bits and pieces. And when we get into the habit of creating this type of language, talking in this way, we're actually setting up the pattern in our brain of how to respond. And then by the time our child fully understands everything we're saying, this has become the norm for them as well. And so we slide more effortlessly into that. So it's never too early to start responding in this way, even if your child doesn't understand every single word you just said.
Totally. It's like reading a book to a kid, right? I don't start reading books to kids once they can read back to me. I start reading books to infants, to babies, not because they're understanding all these words yet, but they're building concepts, right? They're not going to read back to me for years, but we start younger than that to help build those foundational skills and concepts. And for my little guy, for Sage, it also like, it took me self-regulating and like calming my body. And then my body language and tone are so key there. We're like, he's sitting on the ground. If I stand over him and I'm like, okay, I was rushing you and it's time to go eat lunch. Like we got to keep moving, bud. Like, or I was rushing you. I'm so sorry. I was rushing you. But like my tone there is what he's going to hear, even outside of those words. My body language of standing over him and talking to him is what he's going to see outside of those words. And so when I can, it signals safety to his body, which kind of takes your guard down. If I get on his level and my tone is regulated, his body doesn't go on high alert of like, okay, we're in attack mode. His body can soften and is like, all right, my mom's on my team here. We're on the same team. And I can communicate that. We do communicate that so much more than the words we say. If you think of like somebody walks into a room, even before they say something, like you might find yourself like reading their energy. Maybe their shoulders are really like they're stomping their way into the room and their shoulders are up to their ears. And like you can see the look on their face and you might have a reaction internally to that versus if somebody kind of like comes in and they're calm and their shoulders are down. Your nervous system won't necessarily go on high alert. We do this work with kids all the time where we subconsciously, just like not even intentionally, are communicating with their nervous system about whether they should fight back or not.
Yeah. And it's sometimes hard to remember this. And so I'm glad that you're saying it because, as you said, you know, feelings are contagious. And so it's not just, you know, the feelings that are floating around, the energy, the body language, the tone, it all makes a difference. Now, it doesn't mean we have to do this perfectly every time, and it's not going to look perfect. But what we're talking about here is this invitation to start paying attention to these certain areas and picking one aspect to start practicing and just slowly incorporating that practice in one area of your day. And then you'll take all of these baby steps and start building those skills for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And there is no perfection. There's not a single human. And I think this is really hard in like influencer culture, right? Where like people are going to look at my Instagram account or look at yours and be like, oh, I bet that she's perfect all the time. She's always regulated. She's always whatever. And it's not true. And I think that it's a huge part of the problem is that if we think that there is perfection and we aren't reaching it, it can be easy to be like, well, I just can't do that. Like, I'm not doing it and I'm going to throw in the towel. And in reality, it's the moments like where I'm coming in from outside and I am overwhelmed and I'm rushing him and I'm snapping at him. And then when I am able to, then catching myself and regulating and repairing. The other day, I had a snappy 2-hour morning with him, just the two of us before he went to childcare. And I was solo parenting and I had all the stuff happening for work that I was like getting ready to do. And he was inconvenient in the morning for me. And I was like on edge and we had this snappy back and forth for a while. And I didn't repair with him until I saw him later in the day. I couldn't genuinely repair until I had time and space to regulate. And then when I came back together with him, he didn't understand the words yet, but we're practicing where I came back and I was like, you know what, buddy, this morning, I was not speaking kindly to you. I was really frustrated and overwhelmed and you were having a hard time and I wasn't able to be present with you. I love you and I'm sorry. And then we move through. And like, that is a practice for us. And at some point he's going to realize like, oh, it's okay for me to have a hard time and I'm still loved and lovable through it. And I can repair with these people when I have a hard time and work on building some new skills. There is no perfection.
It's a beautiful gift to give a child. I mean, because none of us are perfect. We are all human beings. And to give this gift to a child is, you know, showing them that how to be in relationship with people. And you wouldn't be able to give this gift to your child if we didn't make mistakes, if we didn't, if we weren't human, if we didn't have moments of our own dysregulation, or if we were perfect. And so again, like there's an opportunity if you're feeling like overwhelmed, or if anyone who's watching is just feeling like, oh gosh, I feel like I'm starting 100 miles behind the starting line right now. Just know that it's not that you're doing something bad or wrong, but actually each moment's an opportunity for learning. And in that learning for yourself is learning for your child. And that's a beautiful gift to give. And Alyssa, I want to talk to you a little bit about appropriate expectations for toddlers in terms of regulating their emotions. Because if you look at like surveys that 0-3.org has done or other research out there, we tend to wildly overestimate a child's abilities to regulate their emotions and regulate their behavior. And I often say to my clients that we tend to overestimate a child's ability to regulate their feelings, emotions, and their behavior, and then like underestimate their like physical capability. So we end up doing things for children, for young children, that they're actually capable of doing themselves, even if they might need a little bit of extra time to figure it out. So anyways, what would you say are some developmentally appropriate expectations that parents can, caregivers can have for their little ones when it comes to regulating their emotions, you know, when we're talking about like crying, tantrums, all of these things?
Yeah. So I think first and foremost is that it takes time, no matter where you're starting or where your kid is. They're going to be building a new skill, and that takes time. Again, coming back to reading, like, I'm not reading a book to an infant so that they'll read back to me tomorrow. I'm reading a book to an infant so that they'll read back to me in 5, 6 years, right? Like, it takes time to build new skills. And first and foremost, we have a guide for how to respond in the moment. And what it guides you through is, it starts with allowing a child to feel, which really is on the side of the adult, that they are allowed to feel. And noticing, like, what biases come up for you? Is there a bias around where they're supposed to feel? Do you feel like, okay, it's okay if they melt down at home, but not at the grocery store? It's okay if they have a hard emotion when it's just us, but not when we're at the birthday party? Like, what biases are coming up for you around where? What biases come up for you around age? Are there certain ages where you're like, this child's not supposed to be crying anymore? I was in conversation with a 6-year-old recently, and she was talking to me about how she's been crying a lot at school. And I was like, that makes sense. Like, what, there's a lot that happens at school. Tell me more. And she was sharing that she's so afraid of feeling embarrassed at school, that she's going to do something and people are going to laugh at her and she's going to feel embarrassed, navigating the like new social pressure, right? She's only been in school, this is her second year, and so much of that social part is new. And she was like, yeah, but I don't want to cry at school. And I was like, oh, tell me more. And she was like, well, 6-year-olds are big girls and big girls don't cry. And I was like, oh man, I cry all the time. Like, I have, when I'm have, especially when I feel embarrassed, my body wants to cry first. It is okay to cry. And if you want to have space and cry by yourself, if that feels more comfortable for you, what could you do? We brainstormed her being able to go to the bathroom and cry. But that, what I wanted her to know is, you're not failing for crying. But I think we as adults send these messages to kids all the time based off of our childhood experiences, based off of our biases around, like, they're not supposed to cry anymore. They're not supposed to be having a hard feeling. And like, pause and just like look around you for a minute. Adults also have hard feelings. A lot of us have developed certain coping skills, maybe healthy ones, maybe what we call coping strategies, that help our body feel calm and move through emotions. And some of us are like lashing out and yelling, or like when I was not tapping into healthy coping skills the other day and like snapping at my child rather than pausing. Like, we all have emotions and we're going to have reactions. So first, like, noticing, what are your biases around age, types of expression, and where they should express. And then looking at the fact that now it doesn't really matter if a kid is 2 and has certain skills for regulation, or if they're 5 and have those same skills for regulation. We're meeting a child where they are. If I walked into a classroom of kids who were reading chapter books and there was a kid there who didn't know the alphabet, I would not hand them a chapter book. I'm going to start with the alphabet. And so when we're meeting kids where they are, that means saying, like, okay, I have this expectation in my head that because they're 4, they should know what to do when they feel angry. Here's what they should do. They should be able to tell me that they're angry. They should squeeze their fist. They should take deep breaths. They should move through it. And then they should be able to go back to their thing. Great. That's my expectation. What they're really doing right now is that when they get angry, they're screaming in my face. They're throwing their toy across the room. This is where they are. And this is where I'm hoping they'll get. I'm going to meet them where they are first, because they're not going to tomorrow stop screaming in your face, throwing that toy, and take deep breaths, right? Like, that's not going to happen tomorrow. And so what we look at is, what are the mini stones to the milestones? If the end result is the milestone, the mini stones along the way might be, they didn't throw that toy today. They were still screaming, but we got to a place where I could step in and say, I won't let you throw that toy. And then maybe we get to a place where like they're screaming the word help instead of just screaming bloody murder. They're now screaming the word help. And then we move to a place where they can say the word help. And then we move to a place, right? Like we're taking steps, mini stones to these milestones. And so we're going to first kind of make out, we're going to map out that plan. When I start with a toddler who is screaming and biting, right now I'm working with one and in one of our seed cert classrooms who's doing a lot of biting. And so what we're starting with first is having people be pretty hypervigilant to like when the biting, whenever he's near another human, there's a chance he's going to bite. Whether he seems relaxed, whether he seems upset, there's a chance he's going to bite. So we're a little hypervigilant right now and swooping in and saying, I won't let you bite, and putting a hand between and pushing his head into the hand so that it opens up his mouth. And then we're going, ugh. And our first step is that we want him to go, ugh. And he just started to do this, where now he will go up next to a person and right before he bites, he'll go, ugh. And it's kind of like our cue. That's his, he can't say the word help yet. We're not there yet. He's making a noise that lets us know I need help. And then we'll move on to the word help. And then we'll move on to tools for him to be able to take that step back into calm. And then ultimately for him, it seems like entering into play is right now the skill he's working on. It's not actually like calming his body. It's how do I say, I want to play too, or I want to turn with that, or I want to be next. And we can help him build that skill. But right now it's basically him saying the word help in the only way he can right now, which is, ugh. And we're like, great, boom. Now we can jump in and help him. Does that make sense?
Yeah, this is great. And I want to help clarify for everyone listening is that noticing Alyssa's example that she just gave, if we would have gone from like a conventional parenting aspect where we're relying on punishments and trying to control behavior in that way, if this little boy would have been punished for biting another child, then when we're punishing behavior, we're not creating space for learning skills that are going to not only resolve a behavior, but also help a child be successful in these social situations. And so I just love how this example is showing us how we can teach a child a skill to resolve a behavior. We're still setting limits, but we're also teaching a skill. And I always say the recipe for effective discipline is connection, setting limits and following through, and teaching skills. And I just love how this example shows us that when we are focusing on problem solving versus punishing, we're going to get a lot different outcome at the end.
Sure. And I also understand the knee-jerk desire to punish, right? Like it feels like a safety issue. And I want him to know that this is not okay. And the reality is he also doesn't want to be doing it. He just doesn't know what else to do right now. He hasn't learned what else to do. And so for me, I'm not a Band-Aid on a bullet hole kind of person. Like the punishment feels like I'm going to put a Band-Aid on this bullet hole. He doesn't know what to do, but I'm afraid he's going to keep doing this thing. So I'll punish it to try to get this behavior to stop. But the reality is like that blood's going to seep out in other ways. And so we're going to continue to see a new behavior until he learns how to navigate the situation. How do I get to a place where I can calm my body enough to remember how to enter into this play? How to say, I want to be next. Because now in the calm moments, he can tell us next, next. And we're like, yes, you want to be next. So he's getting parts of this, but he's not able to, in the moment, enter into that regulation to use his whole brain to remember that word next. We're going to get there, but we have to build those skills first. And frankly, it just is not as effective long-term to punish him versus to help build these skills. It makes my job harder in the long term if I'm turning to punishment now.
Yeah. And this child's always going to be looking for someone else on the outside, an external force to help regulate them, to show where those boundaries are, versus learning those self-regulation skills, even though it's a journey. We have to meet them where they're at age, where it's age appropriate, but then help them in these little baby steps or these mini stones to help them get there. So at the beginning of this talk, you talked a lot about learning tools and getting these tools in your toolbox to help respond to a child who's upset, or helping to calm an upset child. Could you just talk about a couple of your favorite tools that we can start practicing to put in our toolbox just to help us calm an upset child in a way that supports their emotional regulation, that supports their emotional safety, and helps them learn skills?
Yeah. So this is the part that is actually not as prescriptive, because everybody's nervous system is different. So for example, someone on our team, we were just having this conversation. She has a 3-year-old and a 7-year-old, and what they need to feel calm is different. One of them seeks proprioceptive input, or like big body play and some deep pressure tactile input, like a big squeeze or a hug or a snuggle. And he also benefits a lot from taking sensory breaks, like having a break from stimuli. His brain can feel really overwhelmed from everything happening around him. Her daughter seeks vestibular input, which is moving the plane of her head. She loves a swing. They have a chair that spins in their kitchen, and she'll sit on it and she'll spin around. As a baby, she loved doing dips and going upside down. And that's what helps her body feel calm. And she doesn't need the sensory breaks in the same way that her brother does. And so there's a whole slew of, like, here are different things. We have a sensory profile quiz that we put together with an integrative occupational therapist that you can go through, and it'll help you figure out, like, for your unique child, what might they be seeking and what might they be sensitive to. So for instance, I'm sensitive to vestibular input, that like spinning. I cannot like go on swings for a long time or spin around. And I have a tiny human who loves vestibular input. He wants to be on a swing. He wants to spin around. And so we have this mismatch of our nervous systems and what's regulating. And I have to be really mindful, like, how do I fill my cup and fill his at the same time? And our sensory profile quiz will help you figure out like what your kid's seeking or sensitive to. And then we go into all the nervous system, each of the sensory systems, so that you can figure this out alongside specific activities for each one. If your kid's seeking this, here are some activities that might be helpful. If your kid's sensitive to this, here are some activities that might be helpful. I can send you that link, Devin, if you want to share. That might be the most helpful, but generally speaking, we're looking at either moving the plane of your head. So spinning, going upside down, doing dips. My child loves to like be on my husband's shoulders, and my husband plays this game with him where he's like, where did Sage go? And he's like looking for him. And as he's looking for him, he's like spinning around. And so Sage is spinning and getting that input. They both are vestibular seeking. That's a great match. I would throw up if I played that game with him. And then on the other side, proprioceptive seeking could be pulling or pushing things. We have a tiny human who, like, every single time there's an opportunity to like carry the backpack, he's my guy. If we are putting things in a wheelbarrow or a wagon, I'm like, can you help me pull this? Or we're bringing groceries inside, he's helping me carry a bag, because he's seeking that big body play, that deep muscle work. He also is forever jumping off of the couch into the cushions or climbing on things, because he's seeking that big body play. And so those are some things that then, like, when we are in the moment, I might tap into, like, let's do 10 frog jumps, or let's see if you can slither like a snake. Can you dip upside down with me? We're going to play some games here with that input, where we're either going to be dipping, spinning, going upside down, or that big body play of big jumps, a big snuggle, to help them find that calm in the moment.
And this makes a lot of sense when we treat behavior as communication. All behavior is communication. It's communicating feelings, emotions, needs, and desires. It's communicating. It's communicating how a child is doing on the inside. And so to recap, when we work on calming our nervous systems, then we can share that calm with our little ones and help them calm their nervous systems when they're experiencing these big emotions. And when we help them calm their nervous system, then they're able to regulate their emotions and in return their behavior. And so I love these examples that you're giving, because it shows us that first of all, every child is unique. And second of all, when we look at behavior not as something bad or a problem or that needs fixed, but as communication, we can problem solve, because all of everything that you're talking about, what I'm hearing is like, we're problem solving here, we're finding a way to support a child in the moment to get help them feel regulated.
Yeah, and I think actually one thing that we run into is the idea of solving the problem at hand to make the emotion go away. And what I want to shift to is we are helping this child feel safe in their body again. So when they're dysregulated, their nervous system just inherently is saying, you're not safe. Whether it's I'm hungry or I'm tired or I'm overwhelmed by all the input around me, they're firing adrenaline or cortisol. And, you know, it's in the same way that like, you can be crying and feel sad, or you can be not crying anymore, but your body still feels sad. Our goal is to help them move through the sensory part of this, the sensory dysregulation, to then be in the emotion. And this is where we can help them maybe solve a problem, or maybe just be with them in it. Of like, it is frustrating when you're working so hard to figure out how to get those Legos to stick together and you keep pushing them and they're not going together. I get that, bud. And then, but we can't have that conversation while they're in the throes of what we might present as like a meltdown or a tantrum, what we look at as dysregulation. And when we can separate those two and say like, okay, they don't have access to the rational brain. They're not making a conscious choice right now. Their body's out of control. I can help their body come back into control. And then we can move on to problem solving.
Yeah, that's really powerful. And, you know, we're not trying to make these emotions go away. We're, I like to think of it as like we're helping them process and move through or be with the emotions. And again, that's our work as the adult, right? Like we all, we've all been there and we all know it is like, how can we be with our own emotions? How can we be with our own emotions so we can be with someone else's emotions? And it takes a lot of time. Yeah.
It's so hard. I literally have done research on emotion processing and have a book on it. And just the other day I said, I hate feelings. They're so hard. Like it's really true. Like being in a dysregulated state, being with a hard emotion is I think the hardest part, is saying like, I'm just going to be in it without making it go away, because so many of us have been trained and it feels uncomfortable to get away from the discomfort. Yeah. Rather than like, I feel sad, I'm going to watch Grey's Anatomy and just allow myself to be sad.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's a practice. I think it's one of our lifelong practices, as just learning to accept and welcome the full spectrum of emotion, of human emotion, without placing labels on it as, you know, good or bad emotions, and just accepting them all as, you know, an equal part of our experience as human beings. And that I think is really our lifelong work.
Agreed. We're not failing for feeling.
No. Well, it can feel overwhelming. Speaking of feelings, it can feel overwhelming to learn a new parenting skill, and it can be hard to know where to start to make a difference or to have things change. So what would you say is one action step parents can take today to get started in really working with creating this calm?
Yeah. Noticing. Just noticing. Like, we're going to notice, where does the dysregulation happen? Is it every time we're trying to get out the door? It's the same, you know, meltdown. When they are playing, what are activities they gravitate toward? When they're left to their own devices, when they're, you know, we had people over the other day for dinner and my child just went up to his room and played. And I was like, all right, because he is my husband's child and is like, bunch of people here, no thanks, I'm overwhelmed, I need a sensory break. And I'm like, oh, a bunch of people here, let me learn all about your lives, let me ask you a million questions, I love this. And but when I can pull back and just notice, I'm like, he needs a break. And when he has access to that and knows it's allowed, he will self-regulate and go take a break, and then he comes back and plays. But just noticing, like, if we don't step in What do they gravitate toward? Where are the meltdowns happening? And then what's happening for us? Like, what am I telling myself about that behavior? Like, for me, immediately when he walks away and like goes in upstairs, I'm like, oh my gosh, he has to learn social skills. He has to know how to be in a group. He's not going to be able to like go to a conference, or what's he going to do at school when he's in a classroom with all these kids? Like, I can spiral into like, what does this mean? And just noticing those thoughts, like, yeah, I'm nervous that he's not going to be able to thrive in a larger social setting. Okay, cool. Let's see what we can build as mini stones to that milestone at some point. What might that look like to build some? But just starting by noticing, because we can't regulate or change or adjust what we're not aware of.
It's so true. I love this example. Thank you so much for sharing, especially this personal example for yourself. Mm-hmm. I love it. Well, unfortunately, our time's coming to a close. I feel like there's so many more things we could talk about, and I know we need to wrap up, and that you also have a gift you want to offer our audience. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, we have that in the moment guide I touched on for a minute there. And it's really like, how do you respond in the moment? What can you do to support your kid in the actual moment? And it's the five phases of emotion processing, which are a part of our SEP method. We outlined in a guide for you, and it includes things like coping strategies and how to help them calm and all that jazz as well. So if you want to link our guide for how to respond in the moment, I'm happy to send it along.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And before we go, is there anything, any final words or something you want us to remember as we go off into the rest of our day thinking about big emotions and what to do with them?
Yeah, there is no perfection. I feel like I want to put this on the billboard. And there's been a huge pendulum swing from how so many of us were raised to how we're raising children now. And I think part of that swing has been towards this idea of we have to be perfect. We're not allowed to make mistakes, and we're not allowed to yell. We're not allowed to lose our cool. And I want you to know that it is okay, and you're not alone. And that every single day, we're just like, all right, where did the wheels come off the bus? And how do I move forward? Is it something that I'm troubleshooting proactively tomorrow, or is it just something that happened today and I'm going to let myself off the hook, rather than like I dropped the ball and then I'm also carrying guilt for the rest of the day for how I reacted? Just to know that there's not a single human out there that's doing this perfectly, and you don't have to. From a research perspective, you really don't have to build emotional intelligence. You're doing enough.
Thank you for that reminder. We all need that reminder. We need like the tattooed on my forehead or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, exactly. Where can our audience go to learn more about all of this?
Yeah, sure. So actually right here, Seed and Sow is our organization, and it's on Instagram, seed.and.sow, S-E-W. We also have a podcast, Voices of Your Village, and my book comes out in the fall, Tiny Humans, Big Emotions, where you can dive deep into all this work.
Thank you so much. Oh, and thank you for being here today. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I just really appreciate the work that you're doing in the world and for taking time out of your life to share it with all of us. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Devin. It's fun to hang.
Wonderful. Well, until next time, we'll see you all again soon. Bye.